Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
I'm Matthew Craig.
We're game designers in real life.
And brothers in real life. That sounded weird.
Yeah, it did. We'll do it the real way the next time. It's another weekly scheduled episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast where we discuss a board game, we talk about how to play it, the strategies involved in it, and then we dig into how it was designed.
Right, yeah.
And, last week we didn't release an episode and we apologize for that. But, you know, we were feeling under the weather and this week we're feeling a whole lot better and we're coming at you quick and strong with a beautiful board game here.
With the episode we told you we would do.
Yes. The episode that we told you we would do that we didn't do, but now we're going to do it now.
Yeah.
And of course, you would only know that if you listen to the Good Stuffs episode where we spoiled it, but Matthew, tell them what game we're talking about here today.
This is Concordia, designed by Mac Gertz, published by Rio Grande Games in 2013, and among the different awards it won, or was nominated, it won the 2013 Meeple's Choice. And it was nominated for the 2014 Kenner Spiel des Jahres.
All right.
Which is the Spiel des Jahres, like, you know, more hobbyist game.
Yeah. How do they put it? It's like the...
I think
the
hobbyist is what?
I thought it was connoisseur. Yeah, yeah. Connoisseur game of the year. So it's a little more complicated than the kind of game that would be nominated for Spiel des Jahres. But, I mean, it's still probably just as prestigious because it is, you know, only three games get nominated a year, so being nominated is a pretty big deal. Meeple's Choice Award. It's a great little quaint little Euro game.
Why don't you go into it?
Yeah, let me get into a little bit about what the game is about. So, in Concordia, players are leaders in ancient Rome attempting to amass the most economic power to please the gods by recruiting colonists and spreading their influence to cities around the Mediterranean Sea, or just around Italy, depending on the map you play on. Players take turns playing colonist cards to produce and trade resources, build buildings, to conduct trade in other cities, and acquire more colonists. Or did I say gather resources? Yeah, I think I did. Colonist cards not only perform actions, each one is also worth a number of points at the end of the game based on which god they represent. Gods will award points for recruiting settlers, building in cities of various resources across the map, and acquiring money. Once either all of the colonist cards are bought from a deck of cards, or one player has built all of their available buildings, the game ends, and the player with the most points from their cards wins. So it's kind of a distilled game piece-wise, where how you earn points is built into the cards that you're playing, and the actions that you take on your turn are all determined by what card you play. There's no, like... keep this in your mind every turn, move a piece, then do a thing.
Right, this is a pretty standard hand builder,
mm-hmm.
where you are gathering cards into a hand, and then the only actions you take are based on whichever card you play during the turn.
Right, so let's talk a little bit about the kinds of cards that you start the game with and that you will acquire over time. Now, something that this game does as a little peek into the design is that the cards that you start with are pretty much the cards you're going to be acquiring. There's very few other types of cards that you can obtain throughout the game. For the most part, you're acquiring more copies of cards you already have. So the cards that you already have, I think obviously you want to start by pointing out the diplomat.
Right.
Is that right? No, the architect.
No, yeah.
Let's start with the architect. So the architect lets you move your pieces around the map and then build in cities. So the map has all these cities around it, and you have these little settlers. There's boat settlers that travel on the water pathways, and there's just settler people that travel on the land pathways. They move on the roads between cities. So you get to move them a number of spaces equal to the number of settlers you have on the map. You start with two, and you have the potential to make four more. And then when they're done moving, you can build in buildings in the cities that border the pathways you're on.
Right, and every road is between two cities.
Yes, so every settler will have the chance to build between two cities. Now, to build, it takes resources. This game has five resources. They are bricks, food, tools, which is represented by an anvil, wine, and cloth. So they start from, like, very basic building materials and food, and then they go up to, like, luxury resources. And the cities all have a resource on them. And you are typically needing to spend that type of resource plus a brick plus some amount of money in order to build in a building. And the more luxury the resource is, the more money it'll cost to build a building in that city. The only exception is a brick city, which takes food.
And if you want to build on a city where another player has already built, you actually have to pay double the price that the building would have cost in money,
or
triple if there's two before you.
Really, yeah. So yeah, however many buildings already exist on the city, you have to pay that much money times that much, that many buildings. You know,
pretty much, yeah.
The amount of money you would have to play multiplied by the number of buildings that already exist there. So. Or not.
It's the number of buildings that will be there after you put it.
Right. Because if there's one, you have to pay twice. If there's two, you have to pay three times. If there's three, you have to pay four times. So on.
Right, yeah.
You get the idea. So that's the architect. That's one of the cards that you start with in your hand. You start with one copy of that card.
And then the next one, which is the main thing you'll do with building your buildings throughout the game, are the prefects.
So on the top corner of the board, the board is divided into regions, and the top corner of the board has each of those a spot for each of those regions. So when you play your prefect card, you choose one of those regions, and every city produces resources for the buildings that players have in them. So if you have a building in a city that produces, for example, wine, and you or somebody else prefects that region that has that city with that building in it, then you will obtain one wine resource, and that'll go into your storehouse. Now, if you play the prefect, not only do you get whatever resources you get from the buildings you have there, you also get one copy of the most luxury resource that comes from that region, from playing the prefect. And if you have a card called the Perfectus Magnus, which we'll explain a little bit further what that means, you get double that extra bonus luxury resource. Now, once you use a prefect on a region, it becomes spent. And in order to get it back so that you can prefect it later, then the other use of a prefect is you collect money and you reactivate all of the regions on the map. And each region, you know, there's like a little token that has the luxury resource on it that shows what you'll get when you prefect it. On the backside, it has money, and you get to collect the money that's showing on the backs of all the regions that have been flipped and spent with the prefect when you reset the board that way. You start with two copies of a prefect. The next card is the other way to obtain resources, the Mercator. So when you use a Mercator card, at least when you use the one that you start with in your hand, you obtain three gold, and then you get to exchange gold for resources and resources for gold. But you do this with two of the resources that you want to exchange. So you choose two resources, like, for example, you could choose brick and tools, and you could take the brick you have and turn it into money, or you could spend your money to buy brick. And you do the same thing with tools. You could sell the tools you have, or you could purchase more tools. But you'd only choose two resources to do that. And there's exchange rates on your player boards. I think it starts with brick costing three, and then it goes just up by one for every resource. So food costs four, tools five, wine six, and cloth seven.
Yep.
So you start with one of those in your hand, and like I said, you get three gold before you do any exchanging, so you can at least buy one brick. But then whatever you sell or whatever you purchase, you know, it's up to how much gold you can generate. And there's more Mercators that you can purchase through the trade row in the game, which is how you get more of these cards into your hand. And those Mercators will give you five gold, the ones that you purchase at the beginning of your exchange. So the next card we can talk about is the Senator. So the Senator is the card you play when you want to purchase cards from the trade row, which are these, the cards that you have in your hand, plus a couple extras, and we'll get into those in a minute. So the Senator, you just can purchase up to two of those cards in the trade row. Each card has a base cost to them, and it depends card by card. Usually it's some wine or cloth or brick or food that will go into purchasing them. Sometimes tools, the cards at the very end of the trade row, which have been in the trade row for a while, you know, because you buy things and it slides over. The ones at the very end are just going to cost what's on the card, but the further back you go to the newer cards, those are going to also cost extra resources, which are displayed on the board.
Mainly cloth.
Yeah, mainly cloth. It could cost just an extra resource of any kind. It could cost an extra cloth. In addition to whatever's on the card, it could cost an extra 2 cloth if it's like some of the newest cards all the way on the other end of the trade row. So that's the senator. You start with one of those. Next, there's the diplomat. The diplomat lets you use the last card that one of your opponents used, unless they played the tribune, which I'll explain in a minute, because basically you just look at their discard pile.
It's the last... top card on their discard.
Exactly. You look at the last card they played, which is the top card of their discard pile, and then you play that. And that can, you know, copy pretty much any card except for another diplomat. The last card, and you start with one of those, and the last card that you start with in your hand is a tribune, which, so you play these cards, they go to your discard pile. The tribune is how you get it back. So when you play the tribune, you pick up all your cards, including your tribune, and then you get a number of gold in for every card in excess of 3. So you count 3 cards, you don't get any gold, and then for every other card you're returning back to your hand, you get 1 gold. And then, in addition to that, when you play the Tribune, you have the option of paying a food and a tool to make one of your settlers, which are the things that stick on the map that walk on the, pathways, that build buildings for you when you play the Architect card.
With the Tribune, oh, by the way, settlers cost a food and a tool always.
Yeah.
With the Tribune, you can only place them in Roma, which is the city that is neutral that everybody starts in.
Right. It's the starting point. It's always in the center of the map in Italy. And yes, when you use the Tribune to create colonists, then they always spawn in Rome. Now, there's a couple of other cards that you can obtain only through the trade row that you don't start with in your hand. The first kind is the Colonist card. The colonist lets you either build as many colonists as you want, as many settlers as you want, and when you do so with the colonist card, they show up in the cities that you control with buildings, and not in Rome. And you can build as many colonists as you want with the Tribune. Actually, I'm not sure. In the with the Tribune, can you build as many as you want, or can you only build one?
No, it's just one.
Okay, so colonists lets you build any number of them.
Yeah.
It has a second option where instead you can take 5 gold plus 1 extra gold per colonist. So if you don't need to build colonists or you just need money, that's one way of getting a decent chunk of money. The other kind of card you can get is the consul, which is like the senator in that it lets you purchase more cards from the trade row. But it only lets you purchase 1 card when you play it. However, when you purchase cards with the consul, you don't have to pay that bonus cost that appears on the board. So it doesn't matter how new the card is to the trade row, it'll only cost whatever it says on the card. The last kind of card that you can only get through the trade row is a specialist, which is sort of a blanket term for 5 unique cards in the game. That are the they essentially will when you play them, they will produce one type of resource from every city you control that produces that type of resource. So for example, you could have a tool specialist. When you play the tool specialist card, it gives you 1 tool for every city, every tool city you have a building in. So it's good if you have a lot of cities of the same type and you just want to produce a whole bunch of resources of that type, probably so that you can sell it with a Mercator. Now, we talked about what the cards do. Let's talk about the other thing that they do, which is give you points.
Right.
So each card has a god or goddess on the bottom of the card with a little icon that tells you how it earns points. And I'll go through these real quick, what they are and how they earn you points. First of all, there is Vesta, which gives you 1 point per card for every 10 gold you have at the end of the game.
Though I think that's only on the starting senator.
It is. It only shows up on the starting senator. You don't find any other cards in the trade row or anything that gives you points for the gold you acquire. Next, there's Jupiter. It gives you 1 point per card for every city that you have a building in that isn't a brick city. So food, tools, wine, and cloth. For any of those cities, you get 1 point per card. The next card is Saturnus, which gives you 1 point per card for every province that you have a building in. Then there is Mercatus, or sorry, Mercury, Mercurius, which is on the Mercator cards. Those give you 2 points for every type of resource cities you control produce. So there's 5 resources, so this can give you up to 10 points per card. To go back real quick to Saturn, there's 11 to 12 regions that you can put buildings in, so that is worth up to 11 to 12 points per card, depending on what map you use.
One map has 12, one map has 11.
Right, and then Jupiter, I think it's... It's hard. I actually don't know what the maximum range is for Jupiter, because there's quite a lot of cities that get put on a map. So, you know, I don't think it's equal to the number of buildings you start with in the game, which is it's probably close to like 15, maybe a little less than 15. Right. But that's Jupiter's upper limits. So 15 per Jupiter card, 11 to 12 per Saturn card at the upper limit, 10 for Mercury cards. Mars is worth 2 points for each settler that you have on the board at the end of the game. And so you have a potential to have 6 settlers, so each Mars card could give you 12 points potentially. And then Minerva usually gives you anywhere between 3 to 5 points for each building of the particular type. These are on the specialist card, so each building of the particular type that specialist is for that you control at the end of the game, you get somewhere between 3 to 5 points. I think it's 3 points for the bricks, food, and tools, 4 points for the wine, and 5 points for cloth. So the more luxury buildings, which cost more to build onto, will give you more points at the end of the game with the specialist cards, Minerva.
Now, when is the end of the game?
So the end of the game, like I said, is when either somebody builds all of the buildings that they have available to them at the beginning of the game, or it's when all of the cards in the trade row get bought out. And at that point, the rest of the players, whoever ended the game, the rest of the players get an extra turn, and then you count points. So you look at all the cards you have, you count out how much each card is worth, and then you count how many cards you have of each type, and you know, you multiply. If you are the first person to end the game, or if you were the person to end the game, you get 7 bonus points, and they have a card to represent that. And then there is a card called Perfectus Magnus that I mentioned interacts with the Senator card. If you have the Perfectus Magnus card, the
Prefect.
Prefect, not the Senator. Senator lets you buy the cards. Prefect. So if you use a Prefect to reap the resources from a region, and you have the Perfectus Magnus, then you get double the luxury resource that comes from that region. And when you do that, the Perfectus Magnus card passes to the right, which is like, or it passes counterclockwise, so reverse turn order.
And the last player in turn order always begins the game with that.
Yeah, so if you go first, then the person going last starts with the Perfectus Magnus. So, strategy.
All right.
We've talked a lot about this, and if you've noticed, this game is a lot to deal with managing all these different types of resources, and because you want to build buildings, which means you need resources, which means you need to use either the Mercator or the Senator, but then, you know, the Prefect, I got to get that right. So you want to use the Mercator or the Prefect, but the Prefect won't work until you have buildings, which you need to build, so I guess you got to do the Mercator, and you start with a lot of resources, but those dry up pretty quickly.
Right.
So where do you start?
This is a pretty typical Euro trading in the Mediterranean style game.
Yeah.
In that, so pretty much pretty, in all of these games.
Pretty typical, I would say prototypical.
Yeah. So in all of these games, the two big things are to reach important goals before your opponents.
I hate myself for what I just said.
And to get as much action efficiency or economy efficiency on your turns.
Yes.
This pretty much can be summed up mainly with take advantage of where your opponents are building.
Mm-hmm.
So when you prefect a place, then everybody who has buildings in that region get resources. So if you think about it, on your turn you might get 2 resources from what you prefect on average. Your opponent's turns, if they prefect a place with you on it, you'll get maybe 1 resource, mm-hmm. but that's almost like getting three resources on your turn.
I mean, it's almost like getting half a bonus turn.
Right, yeah. If you want to be getting as many resources as possible on your opponent's turns.
Yeah.
And to do so, you need to be close to your opponents.
And that usually means building in the same regions, but not in the same cities, per se. Right,
because that is poor on resources.
Yes.
Especially when it gets to wine and cloth.
Mm-hmm. Remember, when you build a building in a city that already has a building, you have to pay double or triple or quadruple the gold cost. And gold is a little bit hard to come by in this game. It's harder to come by than other resources, I think, because only one card provides it to start with.
Yeah,
and then you can access another card. I guess two cards, but one of the cards you don't want to play often.
And so looking at your costs for buildings,
mm-hmm.
food costs 2 gold along with the 2 resources, brick and a food. And if you're second to that, then it costs 4, which is pretty fair because you look at the conversion rates and a food gives you 4 gold.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, think about how many resources can reach that from trading.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 4 resources out of 5. You get to the tool that costs 3, but if you're second to it, it costs 6, which only 1 or 2 resources, the wine and the cloth, do.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to wine and cloth, you have to trade in more than one resource to get enough gold.
What you're saying is if you were to be the second person to build on a tool space, you would be paying 6 gold for a resource that you can sell for only 5 gold. So you have a 1 gold deficit in a way.
However, that six gold can be covered by 2 resources, one of a single resource either way. So, like, you can trade 1 wine to be able to build the second tool building.
But then when you start getting to wine and cloth being the second person there,
you always have to trade
a great deal of effort to overcome the deficit.
Because you're not just trading 1 resource for that money. You're usually trading 2 or getting change.
Right.
And then it's a whole mess.
Right. And having to trade more than 1 resource or multiples of the same kind of resource is detrimental because it takes multiple turns to get that kind of thing unless you have the Perfectus Magnus.
Right.
Or unless you are lucky enough to have the luxury resource in a region. You were the first person there. And then when you prefect, you get the bonus luxury resource plus your own luxury resource.
Of course, there is a worthwhile point in trying to think if it's worth investing in a region where somebody already has, like, a cloth building,
mm-hmm.
but it's been prefected twice already, meaning that you're likely to get your return on investment.
Right. It's good to follow people around and be in their territory so that you can have those extra resources, but it's also good kind of to obviously be the first person in a lot of a lot of regions, because, you know, if you only follow your opponents, then you will encounter a time when you have to prefect those spaces, and then, you know, even if both of you are in the same place, it goes both ways. You know, your opponent might prefect it, but maybe they hold back and eventually you have to prefect it first. And then that means you're giving them extra turns. So while you should definitely diversify, you should have those leeching territories or those leeching buildings and cities that when somebody prefects, you will get some small bonus. But you should also expand to places where people are not so that you can just take whole turns to yourself. And if you have every city, a building in every city in a region, then that can make for some very profitable prefect turns. Because, you know, it's good to prefect a place where you have just one of the cities, but it's even better to prefect a place where you have all three.
Oh, yeah, two for sure.
So I want to talk some cold hard strategy terms right now, without being vague, real quick. I want to say that you want to, obviously, you want to build on your first or second turn. So if you sit down and you look at the board as it's set up on the first turn, you know, you can figure out where you want to go on either your first or second turn. You want to build 2 buildings on your first turn as well.
Which means you have to build 1 building in in two cities that are one space away, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever. You
now,
know.
If you want to build two buildings in your first turn, one of them has to be a brick building, because you start the game with two food and then one of every type of resource, which means you only have one brick, which you need a brick to build any building except for a brick building. So you need to have, if you want to build two on your first turn, one of them has to be a brick building. So what you should look for is where your settlers can move to that will be in between a brick building and another building, or, you know, one settler will be near a brick building, the other will be near some other type of building, so that you can build twice. If you can't do that on your first turn, then you probably would want to Mercator on your first turn and use the gold that you get to trade for more brick. And if you might even want to sell one of your resources so you can buy multiple brick, and then you could set up for a future, you know, or maybe you could even set up for a turn where you buy two buildings with brick and a brick, you know, a food building. Or, sorry, two non-brick buildings and one brick building. You can technically build three buildings. Actually, not on your first turn. You can't move that far because you're still between. Either way. So you want to build on turn one or two. Either Architect or Mercator Architect is your strategy. And if you can manage it, you should use your Diplomat.
As an architect,
because likely everyone at the table is going to be doing this. The first person, you know, has to play an architect for anyone else to duplicate it with a diplomat. So you will always have an opportunity to do so. And always take that, because your architect is probably one of the more valuable pieces at the beginning of the game, since this is sort of an engine building game, and the engine starts with having buildings on cities.
It's dudes on a map engine building. Exactly. An architect both builds your engine and moves dudes on the map.
Yeah, and yes, exactly. So do that. Let's see.
I think by the time you play your first Tribune and return cards to your hand, mm-hmm. you want to be able to build the Colonist.
Yeah.
This is an important part, because one of the main goals, I think, of the mid to early game is to get your fourth Colonist as soon as possible. And I actually have a reason for this, mm-hmm. because if you want to get from, say, with the Mediterranean map, if you want to get from Rome to all the way on the other end...
To the edge of the board.
With a boat.
Yeah.
It takes at most four, or at least four.
Yeah. So movements. So there, it's a web of pathways, this board. And you can reach some surprisingly long distances in a surprisingly few turns, or moves, I should say. But you do need at least four to get to the edges of the board, which is important because, like I said,
you want to be there first.
You want to be the first person to these edges so that you can claim all those buildings at the lowest cost and also reap the rewards of prefecting those regions.
And not only that, endgame, the Jupiter is probably the easiest, or no, Saturn is mm-hmm. probably the easiest to cap at a high number.
Mm-hmm.
So Saturn gives you 1 point per province you have a city in.
Yeah.
And like I said, this is very important because if you think 12 provinces, 12 points, then that's a much easier investment to reach 12 points than Jupiter, which I guess is a similar thing. I don't know.
But Jupiter is it's the same...
True, you're right.
Building investment, but it's going to cost way more than Saturn, because at least for Saturn you can have brick buildings, and brick buildings are very important because without them it's more difficult to produce
any other building.
Brick and build other buildings. Yeah, right. In fact, it's brick is one of the hardest resources to acquire by prefecting because it is the cheapest resource, and so it'll pretty much never be the resource you obtain from that bonus luxury resource, because
right.
you know the luxury resource is always the most expensive resource in a region, and very rarely is that resource the cheapest one.
It's also worth noting that the prefect cards in the trade row are usually very cheap.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to get a lot of the Saturn scoring cards late in the game.
That, and there's more Saturn cards and Jupiter cards, I think, than any other type of card. In the trade row,
you want to,
they're the most common card.
Yeah, you want to, you know, combine those so you're scoring as much as possible.
Yeah, it just multiplies
for every building
every time you get one. So when you Tribune, it's pretty much critical that you build a a settler each time. I think it's also critical that you get, you know, at least 4 gold from your tribunes.
Yeah.
Like, you should try, you should aim to get max value. Obviously, you want to have, like, the most efficient turns you can. And so sometimes it doesn't make sense to play all of your cards before you tribune and get them back and get as much gold as you can. But, you know, you should still try to play it out to an extent. Like, Like, you can probably hold back 1 or 2 cards in the
tribune. I would also recommend you get at least 1 new card with a senator before you tribune.
Yes, really, it's sort of like your goal with your opening hand. Like,
yeah,
the opening
to play
hand,
all your cards,
The goal is to play all your cards and do everything
that they say
important. And that means you need to move and build a building, hopefully twice, by diplomating somebody's architect and then using your own architect. And then you need to buy 1 to 2 cards. Use your prefect to, from the cities that you've already built, obtain resources, which will help you either buy cards with your senator or build more buildings with the second architect that you can play. And then you need to do Mercator for that reason as well. And then, yeah, you need to tribune and get those settlers.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that I have written down as a rule, like an early strategy, is that you should always get a Mercator on your first senator. I think it's the single most important card to get from the trade row, because it's not a prefect or an architect, which seems like the more useful cards, but the architect is going to take a lot of resources to get, and at early game the prefect is going to be a lot worse for obtaining new resources. The Mercators that you get from the trade row are very powerful in the early game. They give you 5 gold to start with for trading instead of 3, which can make a huge difference. You know, it could be the difference between you being able to buy 2 brick instead of just 1 for the building that you plan to build in the future. It lets you save up a lot of money so that, you know, if you don't get a chance to build buildings where you want to at the beginning, you'll have that money left over later on for paying that double and triple cost. So I say, as just like a hard and fast rule, your senator should at least pick up 1 Mercator on your first buy, because it's just, I think it's that powerful
now,
early game.
I do have one more point of strategy.
Okay.
Which is that I think, other than brick, cloth is the best resource to go for early.
Brick cloth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because cloth has the highest trade value, so when you're getting that Mercator and trading things around, it's a good thing to have extras of early game. It lets you be flexible. Also, that, I believe it was the cloth specialist gives you the most points per cloth.
Yeah.
Which is just worth noting. Like we said, it has the highest building price, so getting to it first is that much more important.
Right. It's,
and
being the second person to build on a cloth is very difficult.
And while obviously it's almost always cheaper to get the furthest down card in the trade row, cloth lets you get the extra ones if there's a really important one later on.
And also, cloth is always going to be the luxury resource from a prefect region, so having that extra cloth, not only from, you know, just prefecting a region, but also getting that bonus cloth from, you know, that you get the bonus luxury resource when you use the prefect, it stacks on top of each other
right
nicely. Yes, and so to go over a couple things that we may have touched on, specialize in either Saturn or Jupiter, I think, because, like we said, they're the most common card in the trade row. And if you focus on one of them, it will reward you the most points in the end, because you start to multiply cards on cards on cards.
They're also the only gods you start with 2 of both.
Yes. You want to, by the end of the game, you know, hopefully you've just been buying a bunch of Saturn and Jupiter cards, so you won't have to focus on buying more of them towards the end of the game. You want to just be picking them up whenever you can. But by the end of the game, you should try to sort of max out the rest of your cards if you haven't already, you know, gotten close to maxing them out. You know, it's good to focus on one, but spreading it out a little bit can help sort of at the end of the game. At the end of the game, you'll usually have about four copies of Saturn or Jupiter, and then two copies of each one. So it can help a little bit here and there.
At the end of the game, I think it's more important to buy as many cards in a short time as possible. Mm-hmm.
You should be buying cards through the whole game, really, because that's how you win points. And
the most points, yeah, by far.
Yeah. There's one point I want to make strategy-wise, and that is that Minerva, which is the specialist, is a trap.
Oh, yeah.
Do not focus on Minerva cards. It can be, like, if you're kind of like a deck builder type, you know, somebody who likes to think of alternative strategies, you know.
A Johnny,
if you will. You might like the idea of a Minerva, because it's like, oh, I can just play the whole game focused on one resource. I don't have to think of anything else as much as I need to think of Minerva cards. But they're never worth the points, because you can only get one of them. And the good things about Saturn and Jupiter is there's so many of them. So, you know, you get one Minerva card and that's worth 5 points. And then you could waste all your turns and make it worth one card is 15 points. Or you could get four Saturn cards. And even if they're only worth 8 points, that's, you know, way better than your Minerva card. And they're going to be better to play on your turn.
It's much harder to cap the Minerva cards.
Yeah, it's harder to cap them. And even when you do, it's just not worth it, because you're only capping for one card.
And you might as well have just taken a Jupiter or Saturn in the time it took you to build those buildings.
I mean, you don't even need to take a Jupiter or Saturn, because you start with two of them.
Oh,
so
yeah, sure.
Capping either, not even capping them, getting like half as much, like half the potential of Jupiter or Saturn without purchasing any cards is better than purchasing a Minerva and capping it out.
Right. It's a waste.
Yeah. So don't focus on Minerva cards. Only pick them up if you
accidentally have that much.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you play the Senator and you know, you're going to get a Jupiter or Saturn card and you don't really need a Mercator, or just, it's just what's available to you with your Senator card, then you might as well pick it up. And, you know, it might inform a decision later in the game where it's only a minimal point difference between, like, building a tool building over there or being the second person on a food building over there. Like, you know, they're both going to give you an extra point in your Saturn and your Jupiter, but one of them is going to help you a little bit with your Minerva. But that should be, like, the last part of your decision-making process, your Minerva cards. Your first part should always be about Jupiter and Saturn, and you should always be prioritizing purchasing those, because those are going to give you the most points at the end of the game. And I think that's about it for strategy.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how it was designed.
Okay.
So
I actually have an interesting thing I want to say.
Okay.
I normally don't like 3-player games,
mm-hmm,
but this is the first 3-player game I've played that I felt works best at 3 players. Well,
that's true, because the map is, I mean, like I said, it's either between 11 and 12 regions, and in each version of the board, each region has an average of 2.5 cities in it, I think, pretty much in both cases. So
yeah, and this is a point I wanted to touch on, is yeah, why I think makes it such a good 3-player game. And part of that is what you were getting to.
Yeah.
That in a good 3-player game with, like, map elements, I think if each player can easily get each player can easily get a fourth of the board on average to, mm-hmm, like, themselves, then that one extra fourth is split or contested. If you think about 12 divided by 3, that's 4. Look, mm-hmm, at that. Or, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, also, I want to say that a big part of what makes it a good 3-player game is sort of just part of the whole game, is that the choices are very important, and that getting undercut from a lot of these choices is really tough. So, like, missing out on a card that would have given you a lot of points
from a trade row,
or right, missing out on an important building and having to pay more for it,
mm-hmm,
it's very tough to wait an extra turn, which I think makes it all the better when you have more players. But, you know, sometimes 4 players can feel like it's out of your control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've played 3 and 4 players in this game, and 3 feels like for your first playthrough, it seems like a pretty sweet spot in terms of, like, getting your pick of the litter when it comes to building your first buildings, and then having a little bit of interaction towards the end of the game when you're fighting over some key buildings and cards from the trade row. But then, you know, when you start adding 4 to 5 players, then it's more like you know, a real scramble for the resources, right. And it puts a greater weight on the decisions that you have to make through the game. So maybe that number of players is better when you're more experienced with the game and you can think a little more critically, and you can think a little bit harder on exactly what you need to plan for your future turns.
Right. And with four players, since you want to be following other players, it tends to end up sort of dividing the map in two, where two players go one way and two players go the other way, and they sort of clump around the same areas.
Mm-hmm.
Three player, I think, gives each player enough room to both grow and expand their own way and intercept the other two players.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the board, it even kind of divides nicely that from Rome. Wait, am I looking at Rome right there? No. Never mind. I was going to say, I mean, there's like five or six paths coming out of Rome, yeah. I think. Something like that. Maybe not. I can't. Is that Rome right there on the left?
No, that's Syracuse.
We'll turn it over. Let me see Rome. Show me to Rome. Hello, Rome.
Okay. Yeah, there's six paths going out of Rome.
Well, there you go.
Three roads, three boats.
Perfectly split for three players.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is kind of a sweet spot.
One more thing about it being three player. The first player can get the Prefectus Magnus much quicker, so that it feels like for each player who has it, choosing whether or not to prefect is much more important. Because in four player, like, fourth player can easily be like, oh, I'll prefect, and it's going to go to the third player, but that's still okay, you know. But in three player, I feel like it's a lot more important to judge whether or not it's okay to use the prefect if you're the Prefectus Magnus,
mm-hmm.
and pass it along.
Okay, so moving beyond the number of players,
right. Yeah,
to
sure.
talk more about, first to talk a little more broadly about the game. This game has very little randomness to it. I think this game is, like, your success is entirely your own device. Like, device? Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Devising? Your... The way that you interact with your opponents is very minimal in this game, so how you succeed is almost entirely determined on your own ability to plan ahead and have the right resources for when you play the right cards and playing your cards in the right order.
The most impactful part of randomness is probably just setup, placing the cities on the board.
Right. So the way that the board is, there's each city has a letter ascribed to them, and the backs of the city tokens, which have the types of resources that each city produces, have those letters, and you mix them together, but each region has the same letter to it. So essentially there's very little chance that there's too much of one resource. Like, each region has a percentage of having each resource to an extent that you'll have the same kind of variety in pretty much every game, more or less. But even then, it's still a toss up of what cities near Rome are going to have on them, which obviously is the most important part of setup, because you want to be building at least two buildings on your first move. So the cities near Rome need to be, you know, they need to be accessible types of cities that you can afford to build on. It can't be like all luxury resources, because that you won't, nobody will have the right amount of gold to build there on their first or second turn. But yeah, other than that, that randomness, the only other randomness in the game is the order that the cards show up in the trade row. But since pretty much there's only a handful of types of cards that can show up, and a lot of it is just copies of cards you already have in your hand, then a lot of the randomness is mitigated there. So there's very little randomness. Most of your success in this game comes from your ability to plan. The actions in this game are very simple. Is another part of this game. None can clearly give you points except the Senate, and you only have one Senate in your hand. So how you get points is very plain to you at the beginning, and most of the understanding that you have to obtain of this game comes through just how you're going to achieve that.
Right. There is a clear chain of actions it takes to get resources and points that I think is kind of fair or interesting. That, like, you immediately look at, you know, oh, you get buildings to get resources. So I need to build buildings, so I need the architect. But I also need resources to build the buildings, so I need the prefect and the mercator. And that all leads up to the points, which are almost all based off of the buildings you have.
I think it can be a little confusing at first. And it, I think a lot of the dauntingness of playing this game is removed once you realize that, you know, it's important to play the senator to get points, but it's almost equally as important to just build buildings. And the points will just come to you later. So,
right, it's not as necessary to think, like, I need to get this much value out of a card. Just that you do everything the card says, which I think is hard for people to learn at times. I think it's easy to get lost in, like, oh, I you know, I played the senator, but there's not any good things. Or, like, the thing I wanted to buy, I didn't have resources. I think the game doesn't do as good of a job at guiding the player into that.
Yeah, maybe if there was like an order, like a stacked order for your hand to hold the cards in that kind of illustrated it for you, it might be a little more basic. I think it really just comes in the middle of a playthrough when you just realize the kind of mental steps you're laying out for yourself.
Right.
It's kind of like the... So what I wrote down is that the steps to playing the game are basically... You know, you start with, I want to either buy something with the senator or build a building with the architect. And then you move backwards from there into, I need these resources and maybe this much money. And then you move backwards from there into, I need to use my senators and mercators so that I have the right number of money and resources to do what I was planning on step three in now, step one.
This is something that I kind of want to just pose this as a question rather than make a statement.
Okay.
How far into the first playthrough does the game need to get the player to realize that? Because, I mean, we talk a lot about how games can, like, really quickly tell the player the order of actions they need to take. But I can understand if a game wants to have it, like, you know, it's not necessary until the middle part where you get the eureka moment.
Right. Well, I think the problem with this game... is that the or any game like this is that it's very frustrating when you want to do something and you can't because you messed up the steps to get there. And so it's unfortunate that even just like it happens after the first turn in this game or the first hand in this game, once you played every card, is you'll find out whether or not you messed up somewhere along the way and now you're going to get frustrated because nothing told you that you were messing up until the very end. You know, so
it's sort of like
it's a bad thing that you would get frustrated after, you know, the first gameplay cycle. Right.
But it's interesting that the frustration outweighs the relief when you learn how to circumvent that frustration.
Well, I think one of the reasons why there's not so much relief is because either, you know, the relief is building buildings, which doesn't give you any points,
or the relief is buying
cards, which, yeah, doesn't come to the end of the game. And in some cases, you're just buying cards you already have, so it doesn't feel very special to purchase them.
It's hard to feel... In this game, it doesn't give you a lot of times during the game where you feel a big increase. It feels like you're inching forward ever so slightly until the very end, when a lot of these types of games, there's like a key turn or a key feeling that happens when you're able to play well. Like in Dominion, it's when you draw your whole deck in one turn. It's like, it's a good feeling that rewards the trouble of going into that part. I do want to say that something I like about this game that a lot of engine builder games, I think, should try to do is that every action feeds into or is fed into from or feeds into another action. And this isn't just like the chain of events we talked about, but like, so the Mercator requires resources, which you get from the Prefectus. The Prefectus requires buildings, which you get from the Architect. That requires colonists, which you get from the Tribune. That requires resources and, you know, cards and so on. You get cards from the Senator. Senator requires resources. It's like every action you take that progresses the game in some way technically progresses that, you know, that loop mm-hmm. of resources and production.
Mm-hmm. This does have kind of the benefit that Scythe has too, where because these turns, these moves are so small and incremental, and they at least do something every time you do them, that you're never falling too far behind, you know, because each, although in this game it cascades a little bit more harshly into your future decisions, if, you know.
Especially when compared to other players.
Well, I mean, actually, to continue to draw this comparison with Scythe, in Scythe, if you need to take an extra action, then you just take an extra turn, and then you it takes you one extra turn to fix a mistake. In this game, it can cost you three extra turns to fix a mistake, because you need to play the Tribune to get your cards back. Usually, that's one turn. And then it probably takes you two more turns of setup, because you need the gold and the resources to do whatever you're planning on doing. And then you do it with another card. So that's like an extra three turns to do what you meant to do. So it's a little more detrimental in this game, the way that... So it's a good thing as an engine builder that everything progresses into the next, but it's also a detriment, is what I guess I'm trying to get at here, that if you mess up one part of that process, then it can, you know, yield results further down the line that maybe you didn't anticipate, that'll take even more turns to fix.
Yeah, there's definitely... It does too well of a job of making the player want what the other players have
mm-hmm.
in a non-constructive way. You know, we talked about in the Dominion episode again how a player who's better doing a strategy sort of encourages other players to try that strategy, and that can be a teaching moment.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's so hard to get in on what other people are doing in this game, there's not as much of a relief to that, or, you know, a way to go through with it, and instead it's just, yeah, frustrating.
Maybe if there was something that, like, really highlighted that, like, the architect and the senator are, like, the high points that you should be striving for, and so, like, you should plan for these two cards. When you should, every card you play should go into eventually playing one of these two cards, so that's how you should structure your strategies in this game.
Right.
Maybe, you know, if they had, like, a fancy card border or something like that.
Or, like, yeah, fancy card border or different coloration for the gods on them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least the senator is unique because it's the only one with the purple god on it. But, yeah, the architect has Jupiter on it, which is the same god that shows up on Diplomat. Although, later diplomats you obtain have Saturn on them. But even still, like, it's just, yeah, if there was something that kind of made it highlighted a little more, yeah, it's a little hidden in the game from just a glance. I think that it is very cool how very little you interact with other players in this game. Because like I said, it's a very, like, self-made game. Like, how you succeed is almost entirely dependent on what you do. Nobody can ever negatively affect you. They can only steal slight advantages from you. Usually, you know, sometimes unexpectedly, sometimes you can just see it coming. And stealing those slight advantages is just building where you were planning on building a turn earlier, or taking a card that you wanted to take from the trade row, or prefecting a region that you wanted to prefect. But in any of those cases, you know, building a building is probably the most detrimental thing, but there's so many other buildings on the map, and usually you're not too far from another building of the same type. Taking a card from the trade row, usually that same card is not too far away from showing up again because there's so many copies of the same cards in the trade row. And even if someone's prefecting a region you wanted to prefect, that's usually because you had a building there. And so you're still going to get some benefit off of it. So this game does manage that really well. That very Euro game indirect conflict thing. It's hardly even conflict in this game.
First come, first serve. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hardly even conflict. Let's see. First come is not only served. The indirect conflict is usually represented by a small price increase. Okay, I think that's what I just said.
So I think in general...
Yep.
Going back to just sort of the frustration, a lot of games that teach the player through failure as a way to get them to learn how to play the game, they don't do it as much of like a reductive stance. They do it as like, you did something normally, and then you do something extra than that, and then that is your target.
So you're saying you did something, but you could have done more.
Right.
So it's not what you did didn't penalize you.
Right. And a lot of Concordia is you either do something or like you don't do the full thing. Like you only get one resource off the Prefectus or the Mercator, or you don't build your colonists when you use the Tribune.
Well, I think this is at least highlighted in a way in the game's design, because when you play their architect, it says you can build any number of cities. And this is kind of that thing showing you, like, you could build one city with this. But if you're really playing your cards right, you're going to build two or three cities every time you play this card.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. It has that going for it.
The baseline for a card, when you think of, like, optimal play, isn't easy to reach for a new player. Whereas, like, in other games, there's a lot of times where, like, the baseline for an action is easy to reach, but the special mode for the action. Mm-hmm. So, like, Agricola, the baseline to getting the woodpile first is 3 wood. That's very easy to do. But if no other players take it and you can get 6 wood, that sort of shows you that it's good to snipe out actions that other people haven't took and, you know, play that sort of market accordingly. But that's an extra, like, additive carrot. It's not a reductive carrot.
Now everything we've said in critique of this game also comes with the fact that this was nominated for Kennerspiel. This is meant to be a more complicated Euro game.
It is complicated, not in the rules, but definitely in the learning.
It's deceptively simple because, like, you know, there's nothing to remember about what you do on your turn in the game. It's literally all written on the cards, and you only do what you play. You know, you only perform the actions on the card that you play for your turn. And, you know, there's just resources, and there's just buildings, and then there's just these cards, and there's not a whole variety of cards either. It's just understanding how all the cards work together, how they flow into one another, and how you need to plan very far ahead, because, you know, since one card flows into another, then you can really mess up a future turn on accident. It's obviously a very complicated game in that regard, and so it takes a player that's willing to put in that kind of analyzation effort to enjoy this game. And when you can, this is a really fun game.
Right. It takes multiple sessions and multiple playthroughs to really get it,
which
there is room for that in board gaming. I mean, it's not like every game should be played twice and thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just sort of weird that a game like Concordia, which seems along the lines of, like, Ticket to Ride.
It does look exactly the board looks a lot like Ticket to Ride.
It's way more complicated when you play it.
Yeah. In fact, I'd say that's a fair comparison, this game and Ticket to Ride, except, you know, obviously Ticket to Ride is the gateway game version of what this is. This is a game where you're managing resources, much more different kinds of resources in different restrictive ways. So, take all the criticism with a grain of salt that this is one of the more complicated games our podcast tends to skew lighter games, I think.
I don't know. I always like a good engine builder.
Sure. Although, you know, up until now, what's the most complicated game we've talked? Food Chain Magnet? Food Chain Magnet is probably the most complicated game. And this is probably a little less complicated than that one, honestly.
Probably around the same level as Scythe.
Around the same level as Scythe or Agricola. I like this game.
It's not a bad game by any means. Yeah. It's just not
you just have to really game. Put in that extra effort at the beginning of the game, which is a little difficult. A lot of the games we like involve learning piece by piece. Step by step, like starting knowing nothing, and then by the end of the game, you have a great deal of understanding. This one, you need that understanding from the beginning. And so hopefully our little strategy section at the beginning of this kind of helped you, where you should try to build buildings on your first turn, and you should try to maximize your cards and do everything that they say on them, etc. All right. And that's our episode on Concordia. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you would like to give us feedback, you can follow us on any podcasting platform, leave a comment there, or you can hit us up on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast.
We also have our website at bgbcast.com, where you can find all of our episodes, where we tag them based on what game it is. You can look for similar games or games we mention through that.
We mentioned Scythe and Ticket to Ride and Agricola in this, and we've done
Dominion.
And we've done episodes on all of those games, so you can find them there on our website or just in our back catalog on whatever podcasting platform you listen to. If you're in the mood for just visiting URLs that we shout out at you at the end of these episodes, you can check out entertainthegeeky.com. That's where our friends Chris, Roger, and Jason host their own podcasts on all things nerdy and geeky, newsy and otherwise. And it's also where you can go to their gear store and find your very own Board Game Brothers podcast gear. We have t-shirts up right now,
but we are still waiting to get things settled with the printer.
Yeah.
We'll obviously make tweets and posts and whatnot when we get it figured out. Let me tell you, folks,
no one's more upset than I am because I ordered a shirt and it hasn't come yet.
Our whole family ordered shirts.
Yeah, and they haven't come yet. And I want to rep my podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
It's my podcast and I want to rep it now. you can also, and I know that you won't have any trouble acquiring this, purchase our one-page role-playing game, Merle's Truck Stop in Maine there. It's perfect for the merry month of August, like I always say, and it's a little horror-themed one-pager played with D6s. It's very fun. Check it out. And as always, we want you to keep your eyes and ears open for information regarding our Kickstarter. Not our pod. You know what's happening with our podcast. You're listening to it right now. Our Kickstarter coming soon for our very first card game.
Conniving Cooks. A bluffing and deduction card game for 2 to 6 players, in which players play as chefs in a fancy restaurant, trying to get each other fired while also making sure the guests get their food on time.
So keep your ears open for that, and we really appreciate you for listening to this episode, and we do apologize for missing last week.
But we'll make sure we can get back on schedule, into the swing of things, get the engine going.
Engine building. Hey. We're trying to build our podcast engine. That's right. All right, so thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.